This is file number one, cycle two. Today's date is September 16th, 2015. This is Jean McMillan, and I am interviewing Mr. Chip Hines, whose father was a veterinarian in town, and his grandfather was a blacksmith in town. He's going to talk about growing up in this area. Some of the information will be on Grassland Farm, as well as other places that he's worked, and we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
Okay, Charles Peter Hines.
And your birth date?
July 7th, 1944.
Your birthplace?
Actually born in Canaan at Gear Hospital.
Your parents' names?
Charles Patrick Hines and Ruth Woodward Hines.
Do you have siblings?
Yes.
And they are?
The oldest was Peter Woodward Hines, who perished in the 1944 circus fire. The next one is Gerald Malqui Hines.
What was the middle name?
Malqui.
How do you spell it?
Good luck with that.
All right.
M-A-L-C-U-T-T, I think Malcutt almost looks like.
Okay.
And then myself, and then Margaret Lucille Hines, and then Anne Christine Hines, or Bartolino now.
I've emailed with her.
Right.
Where did you go to school? Did you go to Taconic?
No, actually, my first year of kindergarten, I went to a private school up at Hoxha's because my mother didn't want me in Grove School because of the fire potential.
Mm-hmm.
Then after the first year, I went to Salisbury Central and then Housatonic Valley Regional High School.
Now, I'm going to ask you about some family connections before we go on to your teenage work. On your father's side, your grandfather's name was what?
Peter Hines.
And what was his occupation?
Blacksmith.
Did he have a specialty? Or could he do everything?
He could do everything. He was very well known for shoeing horses, but he was also known for his mechanical ability.
And I wanted to take a picture of the building this morning, but the light was wrong. But I am going to take a picture of the building.
On Walton Street.
On Walton Street,
Walton
halfway
Street.
Down on the right. And your father, now what was his occupation?
He was Charles Patrick Hines, and he was a veterinarian in general practice.
He was born 1913? In September?
Yep.
He had a specialty.
Not really.
Well, you said he was very good with diagnosing things.
Yeah, he was very strong at diagnostic work, but he, of course, it was general practice, so he took whatever came in.
Right. Was his practice always in Taconic, or?
No, it started out on Walls Hill in Lakeville.
All right, and then it moved to Grassland.
In 1944, my mother received the farm after the death of her parents in the fire, from the fire. And so they moved up to Grassland in 1944.
Now, your occupation.
I was a teacher and a school administrator, secondary school administrator.
I'm going to do the maternal side now. Tell me about your Woodward grandmother.
Lucille Woodward was, believe it or not, a college home ec teacher, married to, obviously, to E.G. Woodward, and they came here. E.G. came here to work for as a Scovelm farm manager, and then at some time he bought Grassland from the Scovels, not sure when. And Lucille was very active in starting regional high school because she apparently, where they came from, there was always regionals. So she was one of the strongest advocates for the first regional district in the state of Connecticut. In 1937, the state legislature okayed it, and then it was put together. I think the first class was in 38, I think.
38 or 39.
Nine, yeah.
Tell me about your mother, Ruth.
She was very active in, she liked working with people. Obviously, she had five kids or four kids. And she went to University of Vermont. We have this delightful letter from my grandmother warning her about those Catholic boys at St. Michael's and stay away from them, because they're from Missouri originally, I guess, or Copley. So she was basically a homemaker, and she married Dad fairly early. I don't think she ever finished college. She went to multiple colleges and never finished.
Did she go to school in Taconic?
I believe she did. She has a younger sister by about 2 years younger, Doris Durst. And I do believe they went to the Taconic school. I can remember asking Mom and Dad about all these gates in the backwoods up past our house that operated. You could operate them from horseback, or they also had steps up and over the fences. And the explanation was, well, that's how we went to school. And, you know, they were walking paths, you know, paths and horse paths. She died very early. She died at about, I want to say she was either 45 or 47.
That is young.
Yeah, it was very young. She died of cancer. Mm. Not a fun year.
No.
I always considered her, in hindsight, very much a feminist. She believed that women could do more than they were allowed to do. She worked at the House of Herbs as a secretary for a short period of time. She was very involved with, what is the center now that it used to be a psychiatric center near, and kids and for everything in Lakeville, right near.
Oh, the mental health center?
Yeah, yeah.
Good for her.
Yeah, she was a strong advocate of women's rights and also of women.
Grasslands Farm. Now, the list of owners that I have is from Herbert Scoville to E.G. Woodward.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a sale catalog dated May 23rd, 1936, where the Guernsey cows were dispersed. When did your father buy the property? 1950?
I want to say 1940. 44, I mean, it was,
yeah, okay,
far,
that,
you know.
It came to your mother because her parents had died in the Hartford Circus fire.
Right, and Annie Dorse got something else, maybe she got the money or something, but apparently there was a pretty intense family discussion on who was going to get the farm, because Uncle Johnny, Annie Dorse's husband, was a farmer. Or his dad was mm-hmm. a veterinarian, so they ended up owning a farm in Amenia, New York, just across the line.
How long did your father own the farm? When did he sell it?
I want to say he sold it in 55, 56, in that range, I think.
And to whom did he sell it?
He sold it to David Sybil. And I was going to look up the spelling, and I didn't.
And I gave you homework, and you didn't
do
it.
Well, I tried. And so Sybald, I believe it is.
Sybald,
who owned a masonry company in Newington.
Okay.
And he owned the farm in Upper New York State.
And he sold it to Robert and Sidney Payne.
Correct.
All right, we got that right. Do you know the size of the farm?
I believe it's 270 acres.
And what kind of a farm was it when your father had it?
Absolutely a Guernsey dairy farm. We had my grandfather and father and the Scobles had a world-renowned herd working there.
Did you have a milk route?
No. This is all the the milk was picked up by basically the Torrington Creamery, whoever owned them.
Did you do any breeding of Guernseys?
Oh, yeah. That was...
I would think so, with your dad being a vet.
Yeah. And the whole herd was based... I have books from back in 1917 when the Scovilles owned it.
Mm-hmm.
The whole herd was based on... They had one very famous bull, so obviously it was used for breeding a lot. And the ads in the journals, the Guernsey journals from the 1920s, 1917, indicate they were always selling off young bulls and young cattlehead, and I assume my grandfather did the same thing.
I've gotten a request for information from a Jim Caden, and he said that he was, I think he was a herdsman. Mr. Durst also leased grassland farms. He was there when my dad worked there as a herdsman.
Yeah, Gus Durst. Not Gus, Johnny Durst. And I wasn't aware. I knew that they, by the time I was aware of what was going on, of course, we had the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And John's brother was herdsman for, Gus Durst was herdsman for Wittridge is over in Taconic.
Okay.
And John and Annie Doris had moved with their family up to New York.
When you were living in Taconic, did you go to the Union Chapel?
I remember vaguely being in a Christmas pageant there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only thing I remember. You have to remember, well, you don't have to remember, but Mom did. I'm marrying an Irish Catholic.
Ah.
So they were married... Not on the altar, they were married like they did before.
Yeah.
And the irony is that Mom was the one responsible to get us the Catholic Church and everything. And she was, at different times, she was a Presbyterian. Then she became, her funeral was here in the Episcopal Church. So she stayed with her Protestant roots, obviously. In fact, she's buried in the Protestant cemetery here in town.
The Salisbury Cemetery behind the White Hart.
Whereas my dad is buried in the Catholic one.
St. Mary's.
St. Mary's.
All right. As a young lad, you worked in several different places, and I am going to go through those. We'll start with, I hope, Lucy Drummond.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a business did she have?
She had a stable with over 100 horses in it, thoroughbreds, and she trained horses and sold horses and taught riding and had extensive summer programs for the camps around.
Where was it located?
On Under Mountain Road.
And what was it called?
Holly Hill Stables.
How long did you work there?
Started working there in 1960, and I worked there off and on until 1969.
Okay. You told me a good story about learning how to ride a horse.
Yes.
Please tell me that story again.
Well, much to my father's chagrin, I fell in love with horses, and we had a pair of horses, two Morgans, a match pair. And then when the Civils bought Grassland, they brought horses in too. They had some three Western tack horses. So I was trying to ride one of them, and my father noticed my hands were atrocious. I can't quite use the language on this tape.
Thank you.
But he said, all right, yeah. And he gave me 12 lessons at the Lucy Drummond's, because she taught horsemanship. And he was absolutely, emphatically, clearly wanting me to know if I was going to do it, I should learn how to do it correctly.
I like that.
Yeah, and as far as my hands go, you don't treat an animal that way. And so I started in the pony club there, and really fell in love with the place and all the horses. And at one point, Lucy, whose mother I think was in a home at that time, became ill, and she was spending a lot of time with her mother in hospital or a home, and she needed extra help, and it was freshman year in high school. And so my father volunteered me, and I was very glad he did, and that started my working there.
Wonderful.
It was always a confusion for me, though, between the Western seat and the English seat. I could never get my heels down.
Oh.
I thought I was going to have them surgically cut so they would fall down or whatever. But I really liked working horses, and I also, at that time, there's always a gaggle of kids there.
Oh, sure.
You can imagine. And I found that I really liked working with kids, teaching them something. So I think that was probably the start of my educating experience.
If kids and dogs like you, you're okay.
Yeah.
You also worked at the O'Neill store. Where was that located?
Okay, it's the O'Neill's.
O'Neill. How do you spell it?
I want to say N-E-I-L-O-N-E-I-L. But
okay.
I'm not sure, man. It was Mr. and Mrs. And
Frank and Marie?
Yeah. Is it Marie? Yeah. I would never know her first name.
Oh, no. No, no. But I've heard this from other people.
Frank, I would.
But not her. She
not
would
her.
Be
was
Mrs.
it Marie?
Where was it located?
It was located in Taconic. Right at the
fork?
Right next to the fork. Right next to the church that you were, the little chapel you were talking about.
Which is now gone.
Yeah, but the store is still there.
The store is still there.
And it was a store post office, and it had a dance hall attached to it.
Why did it have a dance hall attached?
Because its summer clientele was predominantly people that went to Camp Everett. And they would come down after the kids were put to bed, and they had pinball machines in there and a jukebox. I don't ever remember anybody dancing there, but it was all about pinball machines. And as a local, we used to crawl under the building and stamp up, and would tilt all the machines on the New York kids and then run like crazy for the woods.
Oh, kids are the same all over.
I spent a long time playing, a lot of nickels spent playing pinball machines there and eating Hulse's cupcakes and so on.
Oh, all that good nutritious stuff.
Yeah.
You said that when you were working there, the store kept open until midnight, and that's because mm-hmm. the counselors would come down. What was Camp Everett?
Camp Everett was a residential summer camp for Jewish kids from New York City.
Mixed boys and girls?
Yep.
Okay. Alrighty. Do you remember anything specific about the Christmas pageant? Were you a wise man or a shepherd?
I remember not singing Silent Night so well. I had a part, but I don't remember it.
Okay. Alrighty. We'll go on to the Salisbury Pharmacy.
Okay. I was driving, so that'd be 1961 or so. I decided that I wanted to work inside instead of outside on the farm. And what better place to work where they had frozen root beer, hot fudge sundaes, fresh peanuts, and Sam Whitbeck, bless him, encouraged you to take it all, and you very shortly became less enamored. And so I went to work there at the soda fountain. There was a soda fountain there. And worked with Anna and Walt and Bam and Audrey and Sam. Well, and I would say I was there almost a year and then realized that I missed the horses. And also, there was time limits, so you didn't have to work as late and stuff. So I think by halfway through my senior year in high school, I had gone back to Drummond's, but I'm not sure the exact date. I know I worked at Whitbeck's all summer, so it would have been my junior 61, 62 summer. They're great people to work for.
I've heard that from other people. I think you mentioned something about maybe Sam putting something so people wouldn't sit by the window?
Oh, yeah. He put on, well, they're like teeth, metal teeth, all along the window edge. Because you know, with the soda fountain there, that was a real natural hangout for everybody. And the way the front windows and display windows were designed, they had a very good lip.
They had a lip, oh, okay.
And so people would just sit there and talk for hours, me included.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, you know, some people were not comfortable seeing all of us people standing there talking, all the kids. So Sam...
Did the metal teeth.
He also had a little trick where he would take a part out of an expensive, like an electric razor or something, an easily replaceable part or put back in, so that if anybody stole it, they got a piece of broken equipment.
Oh, that was clever.
Yeah.
Because there's always shoplifting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about frozen root beer.
Oh. We had... it was Heyer's root beer, I believe, in a... looked like a keg. Now, what I think it really was just a keg-looking thing with a faucet through it, but we had all these mugs that were pre-frozen, and you would pour the root beer into the pre-frozen mugs, and it was just absolutely delicious.
Well, it must have been. It must have been. What's black and white ice cream?
Black and white ice cream soda is basically a chocolate ice cream soda with a vanilla ice cream.
Uh-huh.
And you mix it and you add the two together, and it's still one of my favorite concoctions. Because it's sweet, but it's not overwhelming. So if you have had chocolate soda, you know, it's kind of...
It's sticky sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a trick to making hot fudge?
Well, the trick was not so much the hot fudge, but keeping it at a certain temperature so it didn't overcook and therefore become bitter, or didn't overcook and become hard, you know, because of evaporation.
Mm-hmm.
So that basically was Walt's area, Walt Whitbeck.
Okay.
And he would show you how to make simple syrup, which is, as you know, is superheated.
Oh, yeah.
Sugar and water.
Yeah, I do a lot of that.
I still do it for the hummingbirds. But
yep,
anyways,
so do I.
Anyways, and then it was always our whoever was on call that morning or to make sure that the hot fudge was stirred and kept at a warm enough temperature for the ice cream, but not so hot that it deteriorated.
Now, I'm coming to your education. Did you plan to go to college?
Have you been talking to my teachers?
Who, me?
I had, the answer is yes, but the teachers that I worked with would absolutely say no.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God for Mrs. Gundelli.
Oh, yeah.
She was my savior, along with Mrs. Smith, those two. So... they were all convinced. Apparently I have a learning disability that I didn't know about, but I do.
Yeah, me too.
And yeah, you know, this is before special ed, so
you
go around
it.
And
sure.
You work with it and said,
yep.
Okay, I have to do things differently.
Mm-hmm.
So by fourth grade, I had been in the principal's office like a chameleon times. I loved to build very sharp Indian tomahawks and bring them to school. And the principal, Mr. I don't remember his name, would call Dad up periodically and hand back all these
tomahawks.
And I had one particular student that I didn't like, and I was, for some reason, I was always seated next to him. And he would taunt, like, Nana, Nana, Nana.
Uh-huh.
And I can remember Mrs. Miner, who was a seventh grade teacher, sat me next to Christopher, and I very nicely said to Mrs. Miner, could we change my seat? No, that's where you're sitting. It made no sense because his last name started with an M and mine was Hines, but that's where we sat.
Mm-hmm.
And he started taunting me. And
I
broke a pencil off in his leg.
Uh-huh.
Not nice. And then
no.
Mrs. Miner, I ended up in the clothes closet a lot. That was her punishment. She would put you in the clothes closet. So... the irony of all of this is I went to college. I wanted to be a veterinarian and didn't have the academic credentials to get there. I was in pre-med, went to Norwich University up in Vermont, and then went to University of Hartford, and had changed my major to education, science education, because I always liked science. And my first teaching job was fifth grade at Salisbury Central, in the same room that I had taken fifth grade, with the same teachers who didn't believe in me all around me still. And Mr. Fales,
Cliff Fales? Yeah, oh my.
He was a first year teacher when I was in seventh or eighth grade, and I got all the kids in eighth grade, all the boys, not to catch the balls that he hit out. He carried that grudge right straight through.
He and I retired together.
Yeah, nice guy.
Oh, man, yeah.
But he just couldn't stand me. And Mr. Meter, the music teacher.
Oh, yeah, sure. I remember
in
him.
Third grade, I got the whole third grade, my classroom, not to play the tonette. And tonettes was the precursor to recorders, as you know.
Yeah.
And even in high school, Mr. Meter wouldn't talk to me. And then when I became a teacher, oh my God. And then, of course, Mrs. Smith is the one who played it dumb and left me in the advanced reading group. I never worked so hard in my life to stay in a group. So she really understood how to work me.
Oh, yeah. And you then, challenge.
Yeah.
And you needed to be challenged because you were right.
Most of my friends were all in the advanced groups.
Well, you were going to stay with your friends, peer pressure.
And
oh, sure.
I worked hard, and I think I've learned how to read. My basic problem is by fourth grade, I couldn't read, or I faked it. And then when I wrote on the mirror with the quartz and stuff, that was my way of getting help, and that certainly worked.
You act out because you want attention, you want help, but you don't know how to do it. And so that's what you do, you act out.
And Mrs. Gundelli knew how to play boys.
Oh, yeah.
She was.
There's a trick to it.
Yeah, and she was absolutely one of the most influential and wonderful people in the world. Looked like a bulldog, shaped like a bulldog.
Oh, I know. I worked with her, too.
I don't know what she was like to work with, but in the classroom, she had firm rules, but they were fair, and you could work with her, and she...
That's all you have to do.
She was the one that changed my name from Chipper to Chip. I remember she made a public announcement one day in class, because I was trying to do it. Mm-hmm. She said, for now on, Chipper is no longer Chipper. He is Chip.
Ah.
And that's where it... And that's she where it enforced it. And that's how I can always tell when I see a classmate of mine, they first will say Chipper. Because, through elementary school, I was Chipper. So, anyways, then, and Housatonic, I went to Housatonic, obviously, and had Mr. Kirby as a ninth grade advanced general science student.
Mm-hmm.
Had many a run-in with Dr. Stoddard.
I should imagine.
And there are two people who really... There are more than two, but two that consistently helped me and got me turned around. One was Mr. Dorsett, who was a vice principal.
Edward Dorsett?
Yeah.
Oh, I know him.
Huge guy.
Yeah.
And you know, by my sophomore year, I was in the vice principal's office 11 times before October.
That's not a bad average, actually.
And nobody in society swore or used barn language at all. You didn't hear it.
Oh, no, it was very clean.
And I can remember Mr. Dorsett sitting me down behind a closed door and looking at me and says, you know, Chip, shit or get off the pot.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that, I knew I'd really crossed the boundary because guy would never.
He would not,
Never.
No.
Never. But the other one that helped me, although a lot of staff helped me, but was Mrs. Wakefield, Carolyn Wakefield. She kind of took me under the wing and tried. It was a time when I had to sort out. Basically, I had to sort out that I was not my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I was responsible for my own behavior. And regardless of what your parents are doing or not doing,
it's your responsibility, and you have to face up to it.
She did a beautiful job of that. And many, many, Mr. Just, who was an algebra teacher and a graduate from Annapolis, tougher than tough, stopped a class one day and said, you know, I was upset because I had gotten a C. And he said, you ought to be very proud of getting that C, because you have worked hard, because my Algebra 1 teacher used to give us seat assignments and then go out and drink.
That's good.
And then when she passed out, and I picked up the phone and said, you know, they were yelling at me from the office, why are you on the phone? Well, because Mrs.
So-and-so
is passed out underneath the desk. Dr. Stoddard came in, picked her up, carried her out, literally, bodily. And Stoddard was a big guy.
Yes, he was.
And he, we never saw her again, but meanwhile our algebra education had taken a hit. So we had to, whole year we had to go to, during activity period, to a, what would you call it now? No, anyways, it was to relearn algebra.
So you had to do like a remedial.
Yeah, a remedial, because of what we missed.
Now, I think you told me that you had planned to go to college, but you didn't have the funds for it.
Correct.
And somebody helped.
Yes. I had planned to go to University of Connecticut, A, because my grandfather was the dean of agriculture out there at one point, before the, during the Hartford Circus fire. A lot changed with that fire.
Oh, I mean, sure.
It impacted my whole life.
I didn't know whether you wanted to talk about it or not.
Well, that's fine. Annie Doris, who was the last remaining side of that family, and I said about 8 years ago, we said, we're done talking about it.
So that's why I didn't go there.
Yeah, but it's okay. I've been interested in reading about it. People have their facts wrong. But anyways, so the question was about UConn. So I was going to go to the Torrington branch, which was located in the brand new Torrington High School.
Oh!
Brand new building at that point, while they were building their campus up on Campus Drive. So when certain people heard that, they thought it would be healthier for me to go to a residential college and get away from. There are a lot of family issues, alcoholism, family falling apart.
It's also good for you to become independent.
Right.
And that's a way to do it.
Yeah. So, but I had no money, and Dad didn't offer any. He actually didn't have any money. His mental health problems were getting to him by that time. And so I figured I'd go to UConn because it was $75 a semester. And Reverend Hyde came up and approached me and said, he was also a client of my father's, nice guy. He said, you need to pick a college, and I have a group of people that will pay carte blanche, everything. And I said, well, do I ever have to pay it back? And he said, no, you just have to make sure that you help other people, which I think I've done. I know I've done.
You know you have. If you're a teacher, you always do. I mean, that's part
that's part
of the profession.
Right. So, I went, then all of a sudden I had to pick a college.
Yeah. And
this happened spring of my senior year.
Ooh.
So, I thought, well, maybe the military would be a good place for me because it would give me structure. So, I applied to and got in Norwich University, which is in Vermont, northfield of Vermont.
I know.
And stayed there a year and a half, and my body convinced me otherwise that maybe the military wasn't a good thing for me.
So, but it gave you some background.
Oh, yeah. And it protected me from the hazing I would get in the military afterwards, because whereas Norwich, the freshman year, was all about psyching you out, in the military it's all about physical, so it wasn't, it's pretty easy for me. Then I went to University of Hartford to get my QPA up so I could go to UConn, and realized that I really liked University of Hartford. Why would I leave? So, meanwhile, these people did. The irony of it, the majority of the people who contributed to that fund were people that I had worked with either mowing their lawns or selling watercress. So I made a lot of money selling watercress from Granby to market here and the market in...
Where did you get the watercress?
Oh, my grandmother transplanted it from wherever to a spring, and it's still there, a spring in Grassland Farms down in the backfield, and it just took off, and it was... When I look at the watercress I see today and I look at the watercress I sold, it was much better.
Oh, sure.
So I had a route where other people had a newspaper route. I had a weekly bike route all through Taconic and Twin Lakes and delivering watercress to people who knew what it was. Most people didn't even know what watercress was.
Oh, my.
And so, and Shagroy Market here in town hired me. I had to produce X amount of bundles a week, and then as did whatever the name of the market was in Lakeville.
Well, it was Grand U. No, it was Before National. That. It was First National. It was, there was an A&P.
The A&P I didn't know. There was another one. A&P was down next to Barnett's.
That was down next to Barnett's, but this was right on the main street.
Right.
And that's where I used to go shopping. Yeah. And I think it was the First National.
Well, by that time it probably was.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, and to different restaurants, I delivered watercress. I even had a little card made up.
Clever.
Made up for me. I made...
You did well.
...a ton of money on that. Say nothing about earning people's respect or trust or
sure.
whatever. The only payback, only problem with having a group of people, and this is consistent throughout Salisbury... Because they did other kids, too. Mm-hmm, it wasn't just me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small town. And if you weren't doing well in college,
they knew.
You heard about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there was no free lunch. We're paying for you. We expect you to talk differently. We expect you to act differently, which is fine. And I think I told you about how in the drugstore, when you got in trouble at Housatonic, if you got thrown out, Sam wouldn't serve you.
Oh,
he would say at the fountain, you know, he'd say, well, we don't serve thugs.
Well, good for him.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of town it was.
It still is in a lot of ways. It still is in a lot of ways.
And very supportive, but,
But you have
a give and take.
You have to do the expectations.
And there was no... hesitancy about using shame to shape you.
it's something that's
not
New England.
Yeah.
Tell me about Stanley Mason and Sarum Tea, please.
Oh, I first met Stanley Mason. He was a client of my dad's, and he had this really beautiful accent that I couldn't figure out, but it sounded delightfully different. And then the idea that he was there blending teas, because he was, even then, you know, just was fascinating. He was just the nicest guy in the world, and he would take time to explain. I do teas, and I import them. And then as I got older, especially when I started working at the drugstore, I could see the commercial aspect of it, you know, rather than just the human aspect of it. And we would always hit his place for... trick-or-treat.
Yeah.
He was just really a nice guy. And it was a very interesting place he lived because he was right at the confluence of the two roads that went around Beaver Dam Pond. So one road you would take to, you know, let's start with the private road to our farm ran through from Beaver Dam Road through to our barn. And that was the Scoville, and now it's all overgrown. But that's where the Scovilles had their water supply. And
their water tower.
Well, no, it wasn't even a tower. It was buildings, low buildings, that had these huge sand pools of spring water in them on the side of the room.
And,
So if you're riding a bike, you often would go, because we swam at the channel all the time, which was right at the end of Beaver Dam Road. You would ride your bike down through the farm, down out. We all learned to drive our cars on that road. and drive it out, and you came out on the Beaver Dam Road. So if you took a right, that would take you over to Drummond's eventually, up past the Scovels and the Hamburgs, and then down. And Mr. Mason's right there at the corner. So then he had that little triangular lot, which just made him naturally, as you know, I talk too much. I love talking with adults, so I would sit and talk with them.
Well, that's a good thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. They compare me to one of the Woodwards. I never met them, but anyways.
All righty. Before we close, is there anything that you'd like to add that I haven't covered?
Well, I think the fact that Salisbury, when you talk about a village raising a child, Salisbury actually was the epitome of that. It had a lot of issues and a lot of snobby people, but a lot of really good people who went above and beyond to help people like me become successful.
What a wonderful way to end the interview.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.